When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, this is Josh. Stick around at the end of this conversation with Panos Cosmatos because we have a little tidbit for you.
Hello?
Hey, guys, how are you?
Hey, Panos.
Can you see me?
Can we see him?
No, we see a skeleton. Can see us.
We see a skeleton and a bear.
We see a skeleton. Are you next to a skeleton?
Wait.
That's Don's fault. No?
Hey, there you are.
There he is.
Hey, guys.
Catch you up on our big screen. Can you see us?
Hey, Joe.
Hi.
Yes, I can.
Fantastic. Well, you know Joe. How do you guys know each other?
We met.
Oh, well, fine.
I knew his dad.
Yes. I'm Josh Panos.
Hey, man. Josh. How's it going?
Very nice to meet you.
Good.
A real pleasure.
Colossal microphone.
You what?
You're hidden behind that colossal microphone.
Oh, well.
You're not missing anything.
Fabulous looking young man. It's better you can't see me.
Is my audio okay?
Your audio is perfect.
Audio sounds great.
Oh, my God.
The main thing, because they're only listening to us.
Yeah, they can't see the faces
see
we make.
Glad we made this happen, finally. Not to start at a bummer. I don't know. I went on a Twitter rage the other day. I was doing my Academy votes, and what is it? Because you guys opened VOD the same day you were in theaters. I was not allowed to vote for Mandy for Best Picture.
Yeah, I found out about that not too long ago because I guess they had hired a guy that specializes in trying to do Academy pushes or whatever. Because we were hoping that maybe Johan could get a nomination.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I guess their rules are that you have to have two screenings per day in the first week on one screen. For whatever reason, RLJE had only put it on one screen, but for one showing a day. That took a long time to say for some reason.
God, well, I guess you weren't technically robbed, and I'm not a big fan of ranking movies, and so I won't, but of all the movies I saw last year, the only one I've seen more than once and will see more times this year from last year was Mandy. So
thanks, man.
Absolutely love that film. Are we Don, how are we doing on?
Oh, we're ready.
Oh, wow, fantastic. Okay, so what should we
you're all the nice things you had to say about Mandy are gonna off the air?
Yeah, no, they're actually and I'm not going to say them again either.
All right, fine.
No, we were recording all of that. And I'll give you the new heads up we're giving everybody. If you can find it in your heart to badmouth a well-known movie, that would be great. Because William Friedkin was on too a couple weeks ago and said Exorcist 2 was the worst movie he'd ever seen. And we got a lot of press out of that. So
he'd only seen 40 minutes of it.
I think he's allowed to badmouth that one.
I think so.
Oh, everybody is. It's a football. But I personally
kind of love it.
I do. I do too.
I need to see all of it. God damn it!
It's a very imaginative, if ridiculous, movie.
There's a new Blu-ray out of it. I should get it.
You should.
It might cut
into
my,
it again.
It will cut into my watching Mandy again time. But I have led so many people to that film too. I feel like.
He's got it queued up on auto repeat.
That's right. That's right. But anyway, so
I have a short, tiny anecdote for Joe about my dad that he enjoyed. It's nothing major, but we went as a family and saw a matinee at the AMC and in LA there and down in Century City. And after we came out, they were giving out the score, CineScore cards.
Yeah.
And my dad said, make sure to take one and give Joe an A so that he gets a good cinema score.
That's nice. That's nice.
Fantastic.
It's one of the few theaters that people showed up at.
By the way, the very first movie I saw when I moved to LA, the first movie I saw at the Chinese, and I remember the enormous banner, was Cobra.
Cobra.
Right.
Yes. I had never seen a movie poster that big in my life. It was phenomenal. But here, why don't we roll our music and then we can get into our actual show, if that's okay.
Okay.
But you won't hear anything. You won't hear any music.
It's all done. It's the magic of post-production. This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
We're back. We are here. It's such a thrill. If you haven't figured out from the pre-show chatter, with the co-writer and director of easily one of my favorite movies of 2018, the very great adaptation of my favorite Barry Manilow song. Panos Cosmatos is here. The film is Mandy. And we're not going to talk about Mandy. We're going to talk about some of the movies that have made you into who you are. But Panos, thank you for coming on. It's such a thrill.
That's really awesome to be here. I'm honored.
It is. I mean, I've already said most of this. Oh, you know what I'm supposed to? I have a friend who's actually, he's thinking about leaving his wife for Mandy, and I have to name check him. He's a wonderful heavy metal musician named Colin McCoy. And if I had told him we were recording this today, he'd be sitting next to me. He'd probably be naked. It would be very disturbing. So,
for the film or for his for the fictional character?
No, for the film. For the film. Oh, okay. He wants to leave his wife for the film. Yes. Yeah. No, his wife. Well, he'd never. There's no woman who can replace his wife.
That I approve of.
Yeah. But anyway, thank you, sir. And if you were here in LA, you'd appreciate we're having a very Canadian day. It's cold and wet as we record this.
I'll bet it's colder and wetter here.
But you have come to us prepared, I gather, with a, you want to talk about a genre that is near and dear to your heart?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's what I like to call the, futuristic fascist police state movie.
Wow. Okay. So movies that have nothing to do with the world we live in today.
Exactly.
Correct.
Thank God we, you know, none of those predictions came true and we live in a utopia. So it's, you know, then we can look back on them and with a relief.
Exactly. Exactly. Glad we missed that. Yeah. Well, shall we just dive right into it? Do you want to start with your least favorite?
My least favorite?
He flummoxes people often by saying that, as if whatever they're going to say isn't something they like.
Yes, if you've arranged them in order or just, I don't know.
No, I mean, I would say I can't give you my least favorite, but I'll just start. I would say that one of my, I think a prime example of the genre would be ZPG, Zero Population Growth.
Oh, yeah.
Attention, all citizens.
In unceasing effort to find a solution to the devastating problem of overpopulation that the Earth can no longer sustain, a continuously increasing population, childbearing is herewith forbidden.
No!
The killing of a child shall be the gravest of crimes, punishable by death.
Oliver Reed
and Geraldine Chaplin.
And Don Taylor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, that movie, it's actually quite disturbing because, you know, it takes place in a future where, you know, you're not allowed to have children anymore. It's very difficult to get a license to have a child. So to like emotionally buffer the people who can't haven't been given the license to have a child, they give them these robot toddlers. And there's a scene where, you know, the woman has like a panic attack or something, and she starts to freak out about the fact that their child is a robot. She throws it on the ground and it's just lying there on its face saying, mama. And another great thing about that film is that if you break the law, they sort of hunt you down on the streets and cover you with a sort of hovercraft comes with that's carrying a dome, and they lower it over you.
Right.
And gassed. So yeah, it's a spectacular movie.
That's a very seldom revived movie.
ZPG?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have the poster in storage, and I gotta dig it out one day and put it up on my wall where it belongs, you know?
Did you?
I'm not sure it's on video.
Yeah, it is. Actually, there's a Blu-ray that came out last year, which was where I finally saw it. But it was one of those movies as a kid. I remember the poster freaked me out, and I'd always wanted to see it. And it was the kind of garbage my dad would normally take me to. I say garbage with great affection. And somehow he didn't. But yeah, did you see it theatrically somehow or on TV or?
No. I think I probably first saw it on VHS back in the 90s. It's probably when I first saw it. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. It's,
yeah.
It is trippy and creepy and, very limited locations. One of those.
Yep.
But, fantastic and depressing film.
It's a genre that I really wish. I mean, it does still exist, you know, in certain forms. You know, like I would say that you know, like The Purge is a futuristic fascist police state movie. Purge 2, especially.
Sure.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of young adult fiction that goes there. Oddly, is sort of set in these futuristic fascist police states. But I'd like to see a return to the sort of hardcore R-rated, really, really terrifying futuristic fascist police state. Especially now, you know.
Well, I wonder. Yeah, I mean, Children of Men.
Children of Men was sort of like that,
and nobody went.
That's a good picture.
And it's a great film.
Yeah. It's amazing filmmaking.
But it is interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, but it's interesting. It's become the purview of young adult fiction and films.
Yeah.
I still don't understand how The Hunger Games gets to be a kid's movie. That's
Well, I couldn't understand how The Hunger Games was so able to rip off the Japanese
movie. Yeah, Battle Royale.
Battle Royale. I mean, Battle Royale had the misfortune of coming out around the time of one of our big school massacres.
Right.
And everybody was horrified by the idea of kids shooting kids and all that. And so the picture never got any distribution at all in America. But a lot of people saw it. And The Hunger Games is such a blatant steal from it.
Yeah,
and yet it turned into this big franchise, which everybody's now making tons of money off of. Whereas Battle Royale, of which there have been a couple of other Battle Royale movies, never really caught on to the level of Hunger Games. I mean, Hunger Games is a phenomenon. It's a Harry Potter-ish phenomenon.
Yeah. I don't think that Hunger Games Battle Royale 2 wasn't as strong as the first one.
Oh, you know? For sure. But that first one is so perfect.
I would definitely be in favor of them bringing back Battle Royale and just continuing on that that series indefinitely.
Or just doing it as a game show.
Yeah.
Where people really get killed.
You know? We're getting
it. Go ahead and make it.
Well, do you think there's a reason why kids fiction has taken on that role now and we as adults stay away from that?
Well, yeah, I was going to say about Battle Royale, instead of shying away from it, maybe they should have taken a closer, harder look at it, you know, because you know, it's went away, you know. And maybe, you know, they were missing the point of that film entirely. But I really gravitated towards that stuff as a kid. You know, like there was a book called Devil on My Back. Mm-hmm. That strangely enough, this old lady that lived next door to me, she would give me science fiction books, and that was one of them. And it's a futuristic fascist police state book, and it really, really resonated with me for some reason as a kid. I guess maybe when you're a kid, you feel out of control, you know, or you don't have control of your life, and it sort of resonates metaphorically or something, you know.
Well, sure, and even more simply, I mean, your parents are a fascist police state, aren't they? When you're, you know.
Exactly.
Who can't relate to that?
I guess another film in the genre that I really love, and I love it especially because it's kind of a hybrid, is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
Now, the biggest, the newest, the most exciting of all the Planet of the Apes pictures. Climaxed by the spectacular Revolt of the Apes. The most awesome, the most horrifying spectacle in the annals of science fiction. First pampered as pets, then abused as servants, now oppressed as slaves.
Which is both a Planet of the Apes film and a futuristic fascist police state movie. Yeah. I gotta come up with an acronym or something for that, but Yeah, and it was filmed in Century City, right by where my dad lived, in one of those condos. And so I would always delight to go down there and go to that bridge and stuff like that, and in that mall the way it used to be back in the day when it was still in the conquest style, you know?
Right. Oh, so you grew up around that? Is that
around where?
Around Century. I mean, you grew up when Century City looked like that. You were here.
Well, yeah, I grew up in Victoria, BC, okay. Canada, but my dad had a condo in Century City.
Well, that was when Century City really did look like the future. I mean,
yeah,
there wasn't a lot of other stuff around it. There was just these big, tall buildings and this cool bridge, and it was like the go-to place for futuristic stuff. I mean, Roger even used it in Death Race 2000.
Right.
I was one of the few people on Earth that probably got sad when they refurbished it.
No, hon. I'm with you.
It still looked like that when I moved here in the 80s. Yeah, and it was such an amazing thing having grown up on all those films.
It's completely soulless now.
Yeah, but to suddenly realize, here I am, I'm in the future. It's Conquest is, and the best Planet of the Apes movie, I'd say, at least of the sequels.
No, Escape from Planet of the Apes.
I like Conquest.
I have to disagree. Conquest is by far my favorite of all of them, but maybe it's just because of the futuristic fascist police state tie-in.
Yeah. it's definitely the darkest.
Also, Sal Ricardo Montalban, which I mean, so does Escape also. Escape is the one you said?
Yeah.
That's a really good one.
It's the one right before.
Yeah. I also got actual time travel in it.
It's a very clever way of getting around the fact that they blew up the entire Earth in the previous picture.
But I really, Conquest is so amazing because, first of all, it's got Ricardo Montalban in it again, and this time, instead of being, you know, kind of a comic relief character, he's actually like dead serious the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's glorious when Montalban is deadpan.
Yeah.
And then they also, there's a scene in it that really, really, that I love a lot, is when they torture Ricardo Montalban in this, like, interrogation chamber. And they have some kind of futuristic device that's supposed to, like, scan his mind or cause him pain. And it's just, like, a light. Oh, it's just a lamp that's, like, on a dimmer. It's going up and down, up and down with this amazing sound effect. And that actually kind of really inspired me. And it was actually the key inspiration in Black Rainbow for the whole pyramid suppressor thing was this torture scene in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, nice, nice.
And there's a Star Trek episode as well where they torture Kirk with this like a lamp that I love as well.
Oh, right, that it digs into his brain or something though, right? The shot.
Exorcist 2 has a similar device.
Does it really?
Yes.
Kidding me?
Yeah, it's just a flashing lamp, you know, and it sends everybody into paroxysm.
Say, Fanos Cosmatos, what do you think of Exorcist 2?
Yeah, I love it. It's in the bottom of my heart.
Damn it!
No, we're not going to get any press out of that.
I know. We just wrap it up and go home. Nice. But Conquest is just, it's also the darkest of the series too. It's, that one always felt different to me and I've always loved it the most. I mean, there's moments in the others. I know, Dana Gould, who was an early guest on our show, would probably get into a fight with all of us. He maintains the first one is the greatest movie ever made and cannot be topped. But, Conquest just had this kind of militant edge to it that was, kind of.
And great casting, and there's this amazing line where the sort of main antagonist says, "I'm having a comprehensive list compiled of offender apes." I just love that sort of more attentive villain, you know.
Round up the usual suspect apes.
Yeah.
That's great. No, I'm glad you mentioned that because the instant you told me what the subject was, I started thinking about Century City and an excuse to talk about that.
For those of you who don't live in California, Century City is across from, it used to be the backlot of 20th Century Fox. And when Fox went belly up after Cleopatra and they sold all the land, they built this sort of futuristic pile of buildings that sort of go up to the sky, and there was nothing much around them, which made it particularly eerie.
Yep.
And then they dropped the Nakatomi Towers right in the middle of it, so it had this kind of
And I think it's the Marriott next door was used in Lethal Weapon 2.
Oh, that makes sense. Sure.
When they jump out of the hotel window into the pool. And also in Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man.
Deep cuts.
Well, we have to do a whole show just on locations now. Locations that you can still see in Hollywood that were used in famous movies.
I don't know. Maybe a whole episode on Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man would be. that is the first time that film has come up in anything we have recorded.
Yeah, maybe the last.
God, I hope not.
There's a bit of a slight edge of a futuristic fascist police state in that film, but not really. Not really.
Is it? Well, what's the? Wait a minute. Now I'm thinking about it. One of them is a cop, right?
I actually don't remember, to be honest.
I don't remember either. I don't.
I just remember their outfits.
Yeah, the outfits. Yes. now I have to go watch it again.
And the villains, the outfits the villains wore were these weird kind of like almost like Harkonnen bulletproof jackets that went down to their ankles. Yeah. I still get a thrill every time I see like Avenue of the Stars in a movie, you know? Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's next, sir? What have you got for us?
I guess the next one would be Soylent Green.
New York City, 50 years from today. Nothing runs, nothing works.
They gave me a quarter of a kilo.
But people are the same, and people will do anything to get what they need. What they need most is Soylent Green.
I mean, that's in a way that maybe that was the first futuristic fascist police state movie I saw, and it's definitely, you know, a key one in the genre, in my opinion. Yeah, absolutely.
Off the top of your head, I'm thinking, like, what predates that? That feels like a genre.
There's a TV movie called Shadow on the Land is a fascist police state. A movie where the president is not a good guy, there's an underground of people who are trying to resist the government, and they're being rounded up. It was an ABC movie of the week with Gene Hackman was in it, but I don't think he had a major part. I think Jackie Cooper was the lead. John Forsythe was the lead. It's a pretty interesting movie. It's very hard to find, but if you look it up on IMDb, it's got a very interesting synopsis. It's definitely remakeable.
But I feel like it's a genre.
Soylent Green?
Huh?
Oh, no, the TV
movie.
No, the Shadow on the Land.
Right. Yeah, of course.
I saw Soylent Green as a small child when it came out, and just so much of that. It's a really powerful film.
You know, they're actual Soylent products now.
I know, I keep, but they don't seem to be aware of the...
They don't seem to be aware of the fact that they're supposed to be human DNA in there.
Yeah, that's not a good idea for a...
I read an interview with the guy who created it, who started the Soylent company, and he seemed to me to be maybe a sociopath. I think he
seemed
might be aware
to be
of
maybe,
it,
but yes.
Just quietly to himself, he's aware.
Did he seem aware of the movie? Was that...
No, not at all. Not at all. It never came up, but just the sort of tone.
Where did he get the name Soylent?
I'm positive he took it from the movie, but he just doesn't like he pretends that he doesn't know what that is.
Maybe he never saw all of it.
Maybe he didn't get to the end.
I got to be honest with you. I bought a bottle of Soylent once because I had to try. And it was disgusting, but
have a strange pork-like flavor to it, or
long pig, I think they call it
a long pig. I remember years ago getting a call. It was the strangest. It was a studio thing. They were looking to remake Soylent Green, and
what a good idea.
And the only reason I went in is I had this thing I was working on that I kept pulling on the threads, and the threads always ended at. We're feeding people to people. The end of Soylent Green was the perfect ending, and I couldn't just steal that. And I thought, maybe I can sell them my thing and then build it into. And I went off, and the one thing they were absolutely committed to, they felt, was that they had to come up with a better twist ending. There's literally no better twist ending in the history of film.
Well,
That's mind blowing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's movies for you.
But you know, if you've got one, I think that job still opens. So
it's a good movie. It's I recently saw it at some festival. It was, I think, in Europe. They programmed it and asked me to introduce it. And the interesting thing today about the movie is that because it was made entirely on the MGM backlot, it doesn't exactly ooze verisimilitude. You know, it looks pretty much like what it is, and yet the images of the dumpsters with people,
with people in that them,
it's very, you know, World War II and Cambodian, and it just conjures up a lot of really scary stuff, and it is a very slick and kind of empty looking movie because it's an MGM picture from that period where James Aubrey was just, you know, stealing all the money, but even when you know the ending, it's a very satisfying picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it has a grimy feeling to it as well, like in the sort of hovels where a lot of them live.
Yeah, a lot of dust.
They really went for the hard sell with that poster too of the crabs, are they called, the dump trucks?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The poster is literally just like an amazing illustration of people just being scooped up by the dump trucks. It's gorgeous.
And some of that image as a kid of the dump truck when one of them comes down and squashes a guy was horrifying to me as a kid in a way that so many other things weren't. I mean, I'd seen the Cyclops ripping little miniature guys in half and thought that was great. But there was something about the fact that this was theoretically the country I lived in, and it didn't seem completely and utterly implausible that this could be the place I grew up to live in was really disturbing.
Is that Ulysses, the Cyclops movie?
No, which one is the Cyclops? Well, the Harryhausen.
There's one. Sinbad.
Sinbad.
No, I'm with you. I saw the Ulysses one too. It was with Kirk Douglas, and I saw it.
Oh,
yeah.
I saw it when I was a kid, and I didn't really know from special effects, but I couldn't figure out how they built such an amazing Cyclops automaton. Which of course was just a guy with a fake eye who was blown up, but I just was fascinated that how did they get the skin like that? I was just learning. I was just figuring it out.
We went and saw that in Mexico, weirdly, in a second run house in the 1980 or something like that, and I fell in love with it when they blind him with that sharpened log.
That's pretty good.
That's completely off topic of futuristic police state movies. As far as Soylent Green goes, there's like some amazing Heston moments in it because I'm a huge, you know, admirer of the sort of very juicy Heston teeth clenching, you know. he's a star. He loved to suffer and be martyred, you know.
Well, at the end of Omega Man, he's actually he's in this whole Christ pose at the end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Literally in the Christ pose.
I think we've talked about this a little. It's also interesting that he's in that era. He's in three of the most kind of overtly ideologically lefty science fiction movies of all time, and he doesn't seem.
Well, he was lefty up to a point. I mean, he was certainly big on civil rights, and he was, before he became an NRA spokesman and went down that road, he was, when you read his books and stuff, I mean, he considered himself a progressive.
Yeah. It's just,
he went so far left, he circled around and came back on the right.
Yeah. It's just one of my favorite images of all time is Charlton Heston singing that movie theater and Omega Man lip syncing to Woodstock.
Right. Yes, exactly. That's what he watches alone.
Yeah.
Definitely. There's an amazing scene in Soylent Green where Heston beats the shit out of, I think it's Jim Connors.
Chuck Connors.
And he's like, the thing he's really like hammering on too is that the guy's got strawberries.
Yeah.
And strawberries are super hard to come by. And I almost feel ashamed to this day every time I eat strawberries, you know, because he's like, the Soylent buyer strawberries. And I'm like, every time I buy strawberries now, I'm just like, oh, I'm such a bourgeois piece of shit.
That's hilarious.
Heston's like yelling at me in my mind.
I gotta say, the few times in my life I found it necessary to put a neckerchief on, I always flash in that movie.
Straight, it's the neckerchief movie. Oh my god! And
which really sells the hot and sweatiness of it. It's funny, Joe, when you said that, I thought about the staginess of it all. It's like it never read that way to me as a kid. It always read to me as very real, except for maybe some of those night scenes where people are sleeping on the streets. Those felt like a backlot. But
it's hard to get away from the backlot when you're on the backlot. You know? It's you can hide. They also do some tricks with laying over green colors and some soot and stuff that's all optical.
Yeah.
I mean, they tried hard, but I don't think there was a lot of money to make that picture.
Well, not to mention, it has that incredible montage at the beginning. That's actually kind of reminds me a little bit of that crazy montage that they show to Warren Beatty in
Parallax.
Yeah. Parallax. Yeah. Similar kind of feeling to them.
Yeah.
And then also the scene later in the film where his old friend goes to commit assisted suicide, and they have these like pavilions where you go to die if you so choose, and he lies down in this weird like white dome chamber, and they play this like soothing aerial footage of like fields and stuff like that, you know,
stuff that he can't see. But it's added poignancy that Edward G. Robinson knew that he was dying when he shot that scene.
Oh.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, he had cancer, and he knew it was going to be his last movie.
Wow!
Fantastic final scene.
Yeah, because some of those scenes too with the old what do they call them, the books? Mm-hmm. With him and a bunch of other old actors getting together have a real weight to them as well. Yeah, that movie's better than it needed to be.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that, Exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
What else you got for us, Panos?
How about THX 1138?
All Earth Council, in its infinite wisdom, has decided these two numbers are to be disposed of. The Biochemical Forum has demands to make on their parts, however, before they are eliminated. That's the kind of efficiency that makes you proud to live in this era.
Which version?
Which version?
Well, I do have something to say about that, which is, you know, I'm not a fan of the special editions of Star Wars. But I'm not going to go into that right now because I will literally just go on a crazy, sweaty rant for like 6.5 hours. And I literally won't be able to stop myself. But I kind of like the changes to THX, to be honest. I feel Not all of them are perfect, but I feel like they kind of expand and refine the aesthetic of it without sort of detracting from it too much, with a couple of exceptions. Like when he goes into the cars, showing the highways and stuff from a grander view, I feel kind of detracts from the claustrophobia of that world. But other than that, I kind of like those strange little changes he made, like making the blowjob robot more cartoonish is like weirdly effective in that. In this context, and strange small things like when he goes to turn, he tries to turn in Donald Pleasance, and he goes and puts the card in that box, and now it's got like a weird like beeping light mechanism on top of it, and it's like more bizarre. I don't know. I dig it. I like it.
I have not seen the new version.
Oh, well, I think it's the only version you can see at the moment. Because that's George. You know, once he messes with something, he doesn't want you to go back and be able to see the way it used to look.
Did he re-edit it too, or is it just...
It's re-edited somewhat, yeah. Okay. But I encountered it first when it was his USC student film, which is called Electronic Labyrinth, which is remarkably similar, although much shorter than the feature. We were all very excited because that was one of the best student shorts that anybody had ever seen, and that's the first time I ever heard his name. And then when we found out that the guy who made that short was getting to make a feature version of it, it was inexplicable to us because it was so uncommercial. Yeah. So why would he want to do that? But of course, I guess it was Coppola gave him some money They made the picture, and Warner Brothers was completely flummoxed as to what it was and how to sell it and everything. Nobody went to see it. But then after he hit with American Graffiti, then suddenly there was renewed interest in THX. And over the years, it's become much better known. And I'm not sure that most of the people who see the current version are aware that there even was an earlier version.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, it's fairly subtle. And yeah, if you weren't familiar with the old version, some people might not even register that those are changes, you know. I feel like it's aesthetically the most beautiful futuristic fascist police state movie ever made, for sure. there's an aesthetic to it to THX 1138 and Star Wars that carries over to some scenes in Star Wars that is so refined and so photographically aware. It's I really love the aesthetic that he brought to films at the time. It was so forward thinking and so modern. His use of long lenses and his framing is so photographic and beautiful, you know, and his use of like macro close ups and racking focus along like machines and things like that is it's stunningly beautiful.
Well, he doesn't usually get credit, but he's actually a master of widescreen. And
yeah,
nobody ever says anything about that. But you know, the aesthetic is all the movies he did were scope, and they're all very carefully planned.
Not to mention his use of sound in that film, which carries again into in a more sort of like delightful way in Star Wars. But it's like it's so. Beyond anything anybody else was doing, you know, at the time. There's a strange short film that he made about radio towers or something like that. I wish I could remember the name of it. That again, it carries that aesthetic. It has these beautifully composed kind of shallow focus images and this incredibly dense kind of strange soundscape to it.
I remember reading an interview with him years and years and years ago, and he said, I see him say this a couple of times, that if he ever made, you know, so much money he didn't care anymore, he would just make movies that would please him, and they'd be completely incomprehensible to everybody else.
Well, I think he tried that. Did you ever see Radioland Murders?
Was that Lucas?
Yeah.
I'm completely, really? Okay, fine. Well,
he just produced it.
He didn't. I mean, what happened to that guy? I wonder.
I don't know the guy personally.
No, I'm just saying, sort of, guesses.
He did. Stephen did bring him to the preview of Gremlins in San Diego, and afterward, they huddled together, and George gave Stephen notes.
Any good ones?
I don't know.
That's another, tonally THX is kind of, there's a very, help me out. It's got a kind of, there's a frightening sterility to it.
Well, it's rigorous. I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, and half the time there's nothing on the screen, but the actors, I mean, it's got this great big white void sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where, you know, only Don Pedro Colley stands out.
It's a lonely film.
And the sort of psychic horror of it too, you know, like when when Donald Pleasance, for whatever reason, becomes fixated on Robert Duvall and kind of tries to destroy his life in order to sort of possess him. It's like this weird personal kind of like manifestation of the of what's possible in the futuristic fascist police state, you know,
right.
where there's no empathy and nobody there to talk to or help you. And also, I really connected with the way that he sort of presented religion as still being this strange hollow artifact that's like a hologram almost in this like desolate mall world, you know, and you go and talk to this literally like an artificial priest who's like a flickering, like you know, he looks like like an icon or you know, the shroud even, you know, but it's like a backlit advertisement, you know.
Yeah
It's glorious.
Jesus, these are depressing visions.
Well, it's the future. I expect
the future. It's not depressing. It's where we're headed. Don't worry about
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
we're in it now.
Apparently, we are. Yeah.
I suppose another one would be Rollerball.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Which again has this amazing kind of like counterculture. Of all of the futuristic fascist police state movies, I think it's the one that has the most overt kind of counterculture message. I guess you could argue that THX does too, but it's such a bizarre, you know, overwhelming mood piece. And that, you know, I think, and because it's so hyper modern in its style and in its tone, you know, it's hard to connect. And to its credit, you know, you can't really connect it to the time it was made that easily.
Yeah, for sure.
But Rollerball has this sort of, you know, hyper awareness of the time period it was made in, and the sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Contempt for the ruling class. It's strange watching it now, because it actually, in many ways, feels like a movie about the present, which, because of the its heavy like rootedness into that era, you wouldn't expect. But the way it deals with like superstar athletes being sort of like taken to a god status and treated like royalty is right. really interesting.
Well, that begat Death Race 2000, which is
right.
essentially the same story.
Right,
because all of the character yep. all the characters are athletes and they're all stars. And
yeah.
it's all a big show.
Yeah.
And the president is very Trumpian. He's like, he holds up his hand and he says, "Once more, I give you what you want." And then, and then these wow. crazy cars come out
yeah.
and, you know, run people over for points.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That movie was kind of like the Holy Grail when I was quite young because of that whole aspect of it. But you know, when you're easily amused, that was like beautiful sort of early example of being exposed to black humor. You know,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
and yeah,
yeah, that's true. I remember first getting to see Death Race and realizing how funny it was intentionally.
Yeah,
and. You're right, because at an early age, you don't expect a movie about cars that run people over to be absolutely hilarious.
Well, there was some tension between Paul Martel, the director, and Roger Corman, the producer, because
I wonder which one of them went which way.
Well, I think it's pretty apparent that Roger wanted an action picture, right. and Paul didn't feel that you could do that particular piece of material without humor. And it was also co-written by Chuck Griffith, who was writing a lot of Roger's hipper stuff. And so I was around while the picture was being edited, and there were whole scenes that build up to punchlines that were dropped.
Oh.
So it makes it seem very odd. But there's still a lot of stuff that remains in the movie that's really
oh,
very,
yeah.
very funny and very dark.
That's interesting because, yeah, I remember when I first saw it as a kid, on the first viewing, I was actually just kind of like horrified and traumatized by it initially, like when they were running over people in wheelchairs and old ladies and stuff like that.
Euthanasia day at the old folks' home.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Oddly, the first time I saw it, I like the humor didn't click with me. I was just like overwhelmed with like with horror. I was like, this is horrifying. They're killing these innocent people and they're getting points for it. And I just connected with it in a deadpan, completely humorless way for some reason. But yeah, then when I watched it again, I started to sort of tune in. I was aware for the first time, obviously, that it was funny, but I guess I just didn't connect with the humor the first time.
The real Don Steele is on another planet in that picture. I mean, his performance is so broad that it's a phenomenon. I mean, I tried to use Don in other pictures because he was just such a funny guy, but he was a local disc jockey who was plays this. Announcer who is just so over the top.
Well, then he ends up in Rock and Roll High School, right?
And he's in Rock and Roll High School. Yeah.
Yeah. But to get back to like Rollerball in that era, there does seem to be that era of a few years in the 70s where, and not just genre films, I mean, you look at Network, where there were clearly there was a moment in time where you could see the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because all of these films kind of predict a world that, you know, we're
now living in.
Yeah. And that's disturbing.
I wish there was more film that was being made that was, you know, in its own way, overtly political and kind of speaking truth to power. But it feels very, very, everything feels very, I mean, with some exceptions, obviously, but overall, everything feels very toned down and like sublimated, like people are afraid to deal with it head on or something like that.
Yeah. For sure.
Like I remember during the W administration, you know, where it felt like this is like the seeding ground for a new punk rock movement or something where people are like losing it and nothing really fucking happened. You know, like nobody really reacted. Everybody just kind of sat quietly and that really surprised me. But I do feel like Trump is overt enough and divisive enough that and terrifying enough, maybe that's the key word, that it's sort of, I feel like you can feel it brewing and already kind of manifesting.
In art. I hope. I mean, I've seen, you know, the only other movie that hit me as much and for very different reasons, but this past year was Sorry to Bother You, which is very political. And overtly so.
And I think one of the best pictures of the year.
Yeah.
It's a movie that you think is going to be one kind of movie, and then for a little while it is that movie. And then it becomes a whole different kind of movie that you couldn't even have predicted that it would become. And then it proceeds to build on that so that everything that happens is like constantly topping itself. And this is from a first-time filmmaker. I mean, it's quite an achievement, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And Black Klansman as well, in the sense that at the end of the film, you know, I mean, it's like people need to be reminded of the past constantly, or they forget the sort of darkness of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
the ending of that movie is incredible.
Even the recent past.
Yep.
You know, when he shows that stuff that happened in Charlottesville with the woman being run over and...
In footage I've never seen anywhere else.
Yeah.
I don't know where it came from. But...
It's like that happened so recently, and it feels like people have already forgotten it happened. You know what I mean?
That's the new time frame we're living in.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And even though it's horrifying, it didn't really fully register with me how horrifying that incident was until I saw it in the context of a film. Maybe that's the power of film. You know?
Well, I think so. And also the story that Black Klansman is based on, which is true story, is so absurd that apparently when Spike Lee was first asked about it, he said, "You're telling me this is real, right?" Because he thought nobody would buy it if it hadn't actually happened, and that's I think the source of one of the most entertaining things about the movie, which is it's aware of its own absurdity, and yet it's still a serious movie, and I think that just builds you up so that when you get to the end of the picture and you see that montage, it's so devastating because of what you've just been through.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be funny if we just start talking about like random films that were released this year.
Well, because we don't usually stick to our mandate here.
So technically, because the film was made in the present, it's a futuristic fascist police state. But it was made.
That's right. So that's you're right. Still on topic.
That's right. Do you feel any kind of urge, or who knows if you're already doing that, to get into anything kind of more overtly political in your work?
Sure. I mean, in my own way, I feel like there are sort of abstracted political elements in Mandy, especially.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like towing that line where it's so abstracted that it doesn't become a message film necessarily.
Sure.
You know, but it's there and it will resonate with people. I hope in an almost like a subliminal way.
I mean, there's certainly aspects to Lennis Roach's character and his behavior towards and relationship with Mandy, especially that really while it's universal man woman stuff, it certainly seems timely as well. Without getting too specific, but
it's funny. I started writing that film so long ago, and then the world started to become more like it, and when. I think Trump went into office right before we started not too long before we started filming. And I remember thinking to myself, this character is essentially, if you put Trump and Pence into the Brundle telepod,
right,
will come out the other side. And he has aspects of both of them, you know?
Although he's got he's a tad more well-read, let's say, than those two gentlemen.
Maybe
a little bit.
I'm not convinced that Jeremiah Sand ever read a book.
Actually, as long as we're on it, I promised myself I'd do this, and we'll get back to the hellscape of the future. But I was just talking to Don, our engineer. My wife, you know, you get into these relationships, there are certain concessions one makes, and the toughest one about mine is that my wife does not enjoy horror films. Right. She will, under very certain circumstances, see them. And I probably made the mistake of selling Mandy to her as a horror film before I had seen it. So she's kind of not interested. And I'm convinced that if she at least sat through the first half hour or so, it might lure her into the rest, because it's so powerfully romantic and just this beautiful portrait of a relationship. What would you say to... Actually, we dealt with this on History of Violence, too, because women stayed away from it because of the title, but then they saw the film and they all were very, you know, they liked it. What would you say to a woman who is, or to anyone who might be put off from seeing Mandy because of what it appears to be on the surface?
Gee, it's not really my personality to try to convince people to watch something they don't want to watch.
fine.
But I don't know. I don't think of it as a horror film. I think of it as a fantasy film and a kind of a rock opera, you know?
There you go. Okay.
And it has horror, grotesque elements in it. But, you know, I feel like the violence in the film to me feels like something out of Hawk the Slayer or something like that, you know? Like
right.
The whole film is kind of a fantasy realm, not a hardcore horror film. Although... You know, as I start remembering scenes from the film, I'm like, yeah, I'm basically lying right now.
I'm just going to cut out after you say rock opera and see if that works on it. Just delete the rest. Yeah. No, he meant it, honey. So what's next on your list here?
Speaking of wives, I really have to go give a lot of credit to my wife, because when we went in to sort of rewrite the film, at a certain point, or you know, polish it. You know, she said the scene with her and Jeremiah is an opportunity to do something really, really amazing about the way.
Oh God, yeah, that scene's incredible.
And I think that combined with what was happening with Trump, you know, just crystallized a lot of stuff, in our mind. Anyways,
have you seen, by the way, that there's that amazing illustration that was going around of him before the election that keeps popping up now of the full frontal nude portrait of Donald Trump? That
why would I even admit to say that?
It's kind of horrifying. But I kept thinking of that during the scene we're discussing. Anyway, although Linus Roach is much better endowed than. what's next on our future hellscape?
I think we have to mention Escape from New York.
Oh yeah, yes.
But not Escape from L.A.
Oh yeah,
that one's fun.
You don't like Escape from L.A.?
Not my favorite, though.
No. But I would say the best thing about Escape from L.A. is Cliff Robertson and the president character.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish there'd been more of him in the film, you know?
I don't know. I'm kind of a fan of goofy, ridiculous sequels that don't even try to tap into the appeal of the first film.
Yeah, of course. That goes without saying, man.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Have you ever seen the sequel to Gremlins? Because that one's kind of...
Of course I have. It's mind-blowing. I think it might be one of the first big studio, meta films, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe the last.
Well, the awesome thing about Gremlins 2 is that exactly what you're saying, which is that it lives entirely in its own world.
Yeah.
Tonally and stylistically from the original, which I miss, you know, because now I think starting with Lord of the Rings, they really got into this sort of habit of, you know, people expect every sequel to feel and look
exactly like, and
be exactly like the one that preceded it, more like television episodes, you know? And I love like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where it's, you know, more colorful and more bizarre and more of a horror film, you know. I love that.
Yeah, I remember at the time thinking about just the people who had come to Gremlins 2 expecting that.
Oh, they got Gremlins, didn't they?
They got Gremlins. That movie made me so happy. But I'm with you. I like Escape from L.A. Not to compare it to Gremlins 2, not at all, but
Gremlins 2 has Clamp.
Yes.
Which is a Trump-like character.
Yes, that's right. I know. I have a lot to answer for.
Yes.
Ours is much nicer, though, because he's also based on Ted Turner.
He's got much to account for as well.
But Escape from New York has a great cast.
Yes. Indeed it does. I think you need to talk about Escape from New York in conjunction with Escape from LA when it comes to the futuristic fascist police state film, because yes, there are like overt futuristic fascist police state elements in Escape from New York, no question. But in that film, the president is seen as a sort of hapless idiot.
Right.
Whereas in Escape from LA, he's presented as like a very malevolent, the president is a very malevolent, politically driven figure who like wants, all undesirables to be put on the island that they can't escape from. And he has himself, you know, he's heavily religious and has instigated laws like eating meat is illegal.
Right.
It's funny the weird libertarian kind of John Carpenter libertarian crossover where it's like, is it left, is it right? I don't even know. Like, because it's all about freedom or something, but
well, they live, I think, is a much better version of that.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Except for the 20-minute fight scene in the alley.
I love that.
Which could be shorter.
I love the fact that nobody's bruised in it. But for all the throwing into concrete they do and brick walls, there's not a...
I got to say that scene blew my mind as a teenager. Me and my close friends were like really kind of like obsessed with what we called black hole jokes, which were jokes that started out and then just kept going. And after a while, they stopped being funny and they keep going and going and going.
Exactly.
Funnier than they ever were. And to us, the fact that John Carpenter put like essentially a black hole joke as a fight scene into a film was just kind of stunning and awe-inspiring to us, you know?
I agree entirely. That fight scene is better at 8 minutes than it would have been at...
I would prefer if it was like 45 minutes long. Maybe the director's cut.
Yes.
The Russian version. I don't know.
We can hope.
I went and saw some Russian. Yeah, that's, you know, I was going to heavily digress there. I'm sorry.
Quite all right. You went and saw.
Show
oh,
is,
no, no, please.
The show
digress.
Is just one big digression.
Yes. Yes. We insist. Now you have to.
I just had a memory of going and seeing some Russian film. And I don't remember the name of it. It was in black and white, and it was from like the 70s or something like that. It was not a Tarkovsky. I'd never heard of the guy before. And yeah, I felt, you know, shamefully, I fell asleep. The film was so visually bizarre that when I woke up, and I it was sometimes hard to tell whether I was dreaming or awake. But yeah, it's the lamest digression in the history of the world. And you basically forced me into it.
Now we have to figure out what that movie was.
I take some responsibility. But yeah, the cast of Escape from New York is incredible too. Harry Dean Stanton. That movie really terrified me as a child because it's funny, you know, there's the early scenes where they capture him and they're taking him, or even when he's exploring on his own, he goes down to these underground, like sort of subterranean basement levels, and there's like people just like lying around on the ground, you know, that seem like bombed out on drugs and stuff. And it just seems so threatening and terrifying, this environment, you know?
Yep.
It often makes me think of, there's this a Philip K. Dick quote, which was in Heavy Metal magazine, where they, you know, back in the day, they used to have like interviews with people and like weird movie reviews and stuff in the front few pages. And there was a little interview with Philip K. Dick, and he had just been shown some footage of a Blade Runner, like raw footage.
Mm.
And he died soon afterwards, and he never saw the finished film. But his quote, it was the scene where it was like Deckard was hunting. What's her name?
Prim?
No. The other replicant. After the strip joint scene. Oh.
Yes.
Her.
God damn it! The great actress, Joanna Cassidy.
Yes, great actress.
Joanna Cassidy.
Thank you.
Yes.
He's hunting Joanna Cassidy, and it's like that really dense kind of like environment.
Oh yeah, jumping on top strange. Of the car and.
Yeah, and Philip K. Dick's. Response was, imagine what those people would do to you. Wow.
Yeah.
This paranoia and sort of a strange way of looking at the world was so perfectly present in that quote, you know?
Yes.
And that's why I felt looking, you know, when I was a lot younger and I first watched Escape from New York was this world seemed so incredibly threatening and menacing, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because now I'm an adult or if because I was an incredibly like squeamish and, you know, shy child. And I think, you know, what I was talking about earlier, where I had such an extreme reaction to a film is because I would just immediately connect emotionally with what was happening with like no filter. And, I think maybe that's why I found Death Race 2000. So jarring the first time I saw it because, I was like emotionally connecting with it instead of, you know, going with the flow. But I mean that's the thing I like about Escape from LA though is the more overt sort of political satire of it, I guess.
Yeah.
And
Snake's final act of defiance is kind of satisfying even in that goofy movie. It is.
It's pretty legendary.
Yeah.
Say hello to the human race.
And so Blade Runner must be one of your picks, isn't that?
Yeah.
Dystopian kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. When I mentioned it just now, I realized that it can definitely fall into the futuristic fascist police state.
Sure.
In a way. I mean, technically, yes, you know, I mean, there's police in that film hunting and killing people that don't, you know, quote unquote, deserve to live. I guess, what makes it interesting though is that the world is so chaotic and insane, you know. It's whereas usually in these films, the futuristic fascist police state side of it, even in films where there's a wasteland in one part of the film,
right,
and then the city which is completely like locked down and militarized, you know.
There is no order being preserved in Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's like the world is just like a garbage dump now that they just fall into chaos or relative chaos because everybody, you know, really matters has left the planet.
Yeah,
I guess a really recent example of a futuristic fascist police state movie would be Elysium.
Oh, sure. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. That has all of the check marks of the futuristic fascist police state. It's one of the few full-blown examples of the genre, like a big-budget movie.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
From the recent past, I guess. Well, no, I'm wrong. Now that I'm thinking about it, like 1,000 different movies are popping into my head.
Are they of recent vintage? Because I'm blanking. That's. I mean, I guess Neil Blomkamp's earlier film, a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. But absolutely. Yeah. Minority Report.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe not 1,000, just the one. Just
but no, it's funny you say that because Minority Report somehow doesn't have, and maybe it's just because, you know, I obviously, like everybody here, I came to it as an adult. It doesn't have that chilling, terrifying edge to it that when I think of the genre, I always think of.
No, it doesn't have it. And it's weird because it actually becomes almost like a standard issue political thriller.
Yeah.
In the last act.
Yeah.
Very much like Enemy of the State or something like that, structurally. And as far as the villain being exposed and taken down, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But then it has this overlay of the Philip K. Dick just future.
I always waited. I remember at the end of that film, I waited for them to cut back to Tom Cruise in a jar, and you realize the last 10 minutes have all been happening in his head, kind of a la Brazil, which would have given it that. But
that would have been a great tagline for that movie. Tom Cruise in a jar.
Tom Cruise in a jar, yeah. Well, he'd fit. Oh!
Oh.
Brutal.
It's the kind of joke Nicole used to
make. I'm going to. He'll never hire me again anyway.
I've heard it put forth that if you watch the film with that in mind, you can argue that when he gets put in that jar,
yeah,
from that point on.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting was a call. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's arguable that is exactly what's happening in the film, like the overt happy ending, everything working out right. So nice. It's clearly Total Recall too, you know, like
yeah.
Everything's just happening as you would want it to. But speaking of Total Recall, Verhoeven's
Total Recall.
And it's definitely a futuristic fascist police state movie on the Mars side of it.
Yeah.
And so is Starship Troopers, you know.
Yes,
but especially.
Yes. Yeah. By the way, I apologize profusely and ate my shorts on Blow Up the other day. Have I done this on the air yet? I went back to Starship Troopers.
Oh, you had a problem with Starship Troopers?
Oh yeah, we talked. Well, I want to put this. Starship Troopers was in the can when my first movie got made, and Gabriel Byrne, who has been perfect in the part, had been replaced by a young actor named Casper Van Dien, who we were told was going to be a gigantic star. And I remember going to see Starship Troopers, and all I could see watching, it was a premiere or, you know, pre-screening, and all I could see happening was this guy was not going to be, you know. and that was kind of my only takeaway. And I've had a huge issue with that film for decades. And I finally, after we talked, I can't remember who it was. Somebody here went crazy for it. And I went, all right. And I went back and I watched it again, and I just absolutely fucking loved it. I mean, I don't think you can.
Better late than never, man.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. They wait for us. That's the great thing about movies is they sit there and they wait for us.
Well, that's true.
But
in a way, God. I'm almost jealous, you know, to be able to discover Starship Troopers with a new eye now.
Well, it's kind of a joy to watch what looks like a big budget, dumb studio effects laden thing that, you know, like, oh, come on, here we go. And holy shit. I can't imagine that movie getting made then, let alone today.
Yeah, exactly. The beauty of that, though, as far as it lays in the futuristic fascist police state genre, is that the futuristic fascist police are the heroes of the movie.
Right. Yes.
And that's the glorious part of it, you know. And that's
it's a recruiting movie for them. Is the
exactly.
I think I said this before, but it's just always struck me. Paul Verhoeven had the most amazing run, making nothing but, when he was over here, nothing but movies that said fuck you to the audience.
Yeah, with like mega budgets.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, really mind blowing. Yeah. I rewatched the last time, but one of the last times that I watched Total Recall was when it first came out on HD DVD.
Ah, yeah.
And that I always choose the wrong format. This is part of part of my legacy from my dad, is that he chose beta, and now I always choose the wrong format. We had like thousands of beta tapes. And so I had the HD DVD of Total Recall. Super excited to watch it. And at the time, I was still smoking a little bit of weed, and I made like weed butter and made weed cookies out of them. And it took a long time for them to kick in. And then, you know, of course, there was the initial wave of feeling like I was being haunted by wraiths. But as soon as that mellowed out, then I put on Total Recall HD DVD, and it struck me like halfway through the film, it reminded me of that line in from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, where Hunter S. Thompson says, when he goes to the circus, and he says, this is what will be happening on any given Saturday night if the Nazis had won the war. Popped into my head.
Yes.
Total Recall.
Yes.
It almost, pre-Starship Troopers, it almost has this feeling of like a bizarre alternate timeline, you know, Austrian fucking Technicolor movie or something.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know what the laws are up there, so maybe you don't want to, but do you still occasionally partake, or?
No. It just made me so paranoid. And the last time I did it was my wife took me to see the Yes concert.
Okay.
Which is like, there's like one original member or something like that now, and then a bunch of session musicians. And that was a trying ordeal for me. it was very intense. Yeah.
Because they have stuff down here now that weeds out all the bad parts. Excuse the pun. Yeah. And I gotta recommend, you may be sick of looking at it, but you have not seen Mandy until you've.
Yeah, I'm going to do that one day.
Do a microdose of acid too.
Highly recommend.
Somebody told me that they went and saw it in acid, and I was like, "Why would they do that?" I remember there was a screening of Black Rainbow
long
years ago, and a bunch of people that I knew all took mushrooms, and they were all enraged with me when they came out. And I was like, "Nobody told you to do that. I didn't recommend it. Like, that was a foolish move."
Fantastic.
But yeah, I think that's the thing with those. I'm kind of making them as if I'm making them because I can't get high anymore. So fully high for me, you know.
Interesting. Man. I have to try that sometime.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else you'd like to throw in before we?
No, I feel, unless you want a less awkward ending, that I have nothing.
No, that's fantastic. It's been a wonderful and kind of weirdly depressing conversation.
And thank you for coming through the airwaves from.
Yes, thank you for that. And thank you so much for Mandy. Hey, it's Josh again. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And I just wanted to play a tiny little bit for you from last week's episode with Karin Kusama, who, if you listen to the show, you know, has exquisite taste in all things cinematic. But she was also a giant, giant fan of Mandy. And we recorded a little bit of her talking about it before the show last week. So here's Karin Kusama waxing rhapsodic about Mandy.
Yeah, giant. Well, it's one chainsaw, and then the other guy's like, other I've guy's got even a bigger chainsaw.
That's what guys do.
Utterly absurd. And when that happened, Phil, my husband, just couldn't stop laughing. He was like, okay, I feel like this movie is really acknowledging its
over-the-topness.
Yeah. I guess that's what I love, because it is so moving and so emotional and so goddamn funny.
Oh, my God. When you see them meet or see each other for the first time,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just so deeply moved by that.
Yeah. Just in their conversations in bed. And
there was a line of dialogue that in the first viewing I hadn't heard or quite understood. And then in the second viewing, when Linus Roach gives his like psychotic, you know, everything in front of me belongs to me speech,
right.
Which is sort of a stand-in for, you know, where we're at politically right now. And he's kind of like, well, what do you think of that? And she, through her like horrifically drugged state, can still say, I fear the Reaper is fast approaching. And then to see Nick Cage go to Bill Duke for the Reaper and realize, oh, she knew he was going to come for her.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's
that's how much of a team they were. Yeah. I literally was like, Phil, I need a t-shirt that says, I fear
the Reaper is fast approaching. Yes.
Because guys, it is.
That's so funny. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen it twice. And I'm having some folks over to see it in a week or two for the third time.
Because it's sort
of one of those movies you have to lead people to, I think.
That's part of the fun, is leading people to movies that they wouldn't ordinarily see.
Yes.
And actually a couple of them that we'll talk about today, I was led to. So I'm excited.
Don't tell Joe yet.
I won't.
Our show was recorded in Hollywood, California, at Crossroads of the World. We're the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.